sofa beside her and found it was she.
Hello, this is Julie Candler with the BBC News. The founder of the cryptocurrency exchange FTX, Sam Bankman-Fried, has been sentenced to 25 years in jail in the United States for fraud and money laundering. He had earlier been found guilty of stealing billions of dollars from his customers in one of the biggest financial frauds in US history. Our cyber correspondent Joe Tidy followed the trial.
The defense side tried to portray today Sam Bankman-Fried as, you know, a maths geek out of his depth, made some big mistakes. And he took the stand as well, and he said repeatedly, "I'm sorry for all the damage I caused." But he was adamant that none of it was deliberate and that the money would be returned and has been recovered. But the judge spoke at length about the ambition of Sam Bankman-Fried and also, in his words, his lack of remorse. Judge Kaplan said that Bankman-Fried was motivated by a drive to be politically influential. This was all a front, his idea that he was just wanted to make money and give to charity.
Judges at the World Court have unanimously ordered Israel to take all necessary action to ensure basic food supplies reach the Palestinian population in Gaza. The International Court of Justice in The Hague said the Israeli government must ensure that its military does not violate the International Convention on Genocide, including by preventing the delivery of urgently needed humanitarian assistance. Israel has vehemently denied that its military campaign aimed at Hamas is illegal. Russia has used its UN Security Council veto to block the renewal of an expert panel that monitors the enforcement of sanctions against North Korea. China abstained, while the remaining 13 countries voted in favour. Mickey Bristow reports.
For the last 15 years, a group of eight experts has reported to the UN twice a year on the sanctions regime imposed on North Korea to see how it's working. That will now stop after Russia vetoed the renewal of the panel's mandate. North Korea has been accused of supplying Russia with weapons and ammunition for its war in Ukraine in return for food and fuel. This would contravene UN sanctions. Some are already arguing that Russia has vetoed the panel in order to hide this trade.
The National Assembly in France has voted overwhelmingly in favour of a bill which would penalise workplace discrimination based on an employee's hairstyle. Hugh Schofield has the details.
The bill, which was introduced by a member of parliament from the French Caribbean, states that it's against the law to discriminate on the basis of the cut, length, colour or texture of a person's hair. Though in its preamble, the bill states that blondes, redheads and indeed balding people are all potentially victims of what it calls hair prejudice, it's clear that the main target is black men and women, some of whom, it said, still feel under pressure to undergo hair straightening in order to fit in at work or socially.
World News from the BBC. The United States government is updating the way it collects federal data on people's race and ethnicity. It's the first such change since 1997. New official forms will allow people to tick multiple options on how they identify themselves, such as black, American Indian, and Hispanic. Officials say the new standards are designed to reflect diverse, modern views of racial and ethnic identity. Several countries are joining forces to send troops to France to bolster security at the Paris Olympics. The news was announced by Poland's defence minister after talks in Warsaw with France's top general. It's still not clear which countries and how many troops are involved. The main objective would be to detect explosives and prevent acts of terrorism. The UN Human Rights Chief says an arms embargo must be enforced in Haiti, where more than 1,500 people have been killed so far this year in gang violence, including lynchings. Volker Turk said large numbers of weapons were continuing to come into the country, where criminal gangs still control much of the capital.
The situation in Haiti is cataclysmic. Corruption, impunity and poor governance, compounded by increasing levels of gang violence, have eroded the rule of law and brought state institutions close to collapse. Gangs continued to use sexual violence to brutalize, punish, and control people. Some women are forced into exploitative sexual relations with gang members. In addition, the rape of kidnapped hostages continues to be used to coerce families into paying ransoms.
Officials in Madagascar say a tropical storm has killed at least 11 people and destroyed hundreds of homes. Cyclone Gamand swept through the northeastern region of Sava on Wednesday. Torrents of water rush through the villages, cutting off roads and washing away houses. Several bridges collapsed, cutting the region off from the rest of Madagascar. BBC News.
In addition to the generous support of listener sponsors, the local businesses and organizations that underwrite WORT's programming play a vital role in the financial health of your community radio station. WORT is grateful for the support of our underwriters, and when you visit these businesses and organizations, please let them know that their support of WORT is appreciated. For information on how to become a WORT underwriter, contact me, Doug Holtz, at 608-256-2001 or visit our website at wortfm.org.
Six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation.
And good afternoon. Welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. So how do we understand the contemporary global role of the U.S., once but no longer the planet's reigning imperial superpower? Where might things be headed as Washington grapples with an increasing array of simultaneous crises abroad? Joining us today to help possibly answer some of these questions and more is Professor Al McCoy with the History Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, of late a global historian. In recent years, his focus as a scholar and public intellectual has honed in on the rise and decline of modern empires, if for no other reason than to shed light on the shifting role of the United States as a world power. He is the author of, among numerous other works, In the Shadow of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power, and his most recent book, To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change. Today we'll be drawing from his recent thought piece that appeared on the Tom Dispatch website on March 12th, a column titled, with question marks, interestingly, The American Empire in Ultimate Crisis, Decline and Fall of It All. Welcome back, Al McCoy.
Alan, happy to be here.
You know, Al McCoy, you began your recent Tom Dispatch piece by observing that empires don't just fall like toppled trees. Instead, they weaken slowly as a succession of crises drain their strength and confidence until they suddenly begin to disintegrate. Continuing on, you wrote that America's post-Cold War victory lap suffered its own crisis early in the century with disastrous invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, that now just over history's horizon are three more imperial crises in Gaza, in Taiwan, and Ukraine that could cumulatively turn a slow imperial recessional into an all too rapid decline, if not collapse. Al McCoy, let's put the very idea of an imperial crisis in perspective. You say that the history of every empire, ancient or modern, has always involved a succession of crises. The U.S. has had its share. Sketch that out a little bit. Sketch for us in broad brushstrokes, perhaps, your take on the U.S. role in the post-World War two decades.
Sure. First of all, to place it in context, what you said earlier, think about, let's say, the British Empire, okay? Their long recessional was marked by, first of all, a crisis in India, then in Palestine, and they had trouble in Kenya, but the thing that broke them was the Suez Crisis of 1956, which essentially ended the idea of the British Empire and forced Britain in the next decade to undertake a very rapid imperial retreat. The same with France. They first of all had the crisis of the war in Indochina during the 1950s, a simultaneous war in Madagascar, and then the Algerian crisis was something that they simply could not recover from. In fact, liquidating that crisis plunged France itself into a major civil war There were three assassination attempts on President de Gaulle by the right-wing disgruntled generals who were running the pacification of Algeria during that colonial war. And so it was Algeria that really brought an end to the formal French Empire. Same with Russia. During their day, they had recurring crises. Hungary 56, the Prague Spring in Czechoslovakia in 1968. They had troubles in Ethiopia. They had recurring troubles in Egypt. But then the thing that really undid them was the decade-long crisis during the 1980s in Afghanistan, which Gorbachev called the bleeding wound of Afghanistan. And from that, they simply could not recover. And so when Eastern Europe erupted in dissent, the Soviet Union no longer had the power or the will to maintain its East European empire. The United States, like all empires, right from the moment of its ascent at the close of World War II, when it became history's most powerful empire, a global array of power absolutely unprecedented in human history. But right from the beginning, amidst this, as we stood like a titan astride the globe, there were crises. And the question was, how were those crises managed? So the United States faced crises in Greece, Italy, France, the Berlin airlift, the subsequent Berlin crisis, the Korean War. And the Korean War, you know, was not well managed, but nonetheless, the United States managed to pull an armistice out of it and accept the division of the peninsula. And so the United States, at the peak of its power, managed all these crises. Now what we're seeing is that in the, looks to me like the long decline of U.S. global power, you know, we scaled the heights, and therefore we have a long way to come down. And the long decline was marked, first of all, by the intervention in March 2003 in Iraq, which proved a disastrous defeat, ultimately. Then the subsequent intervention in Afghanistan, the U.S. 20-year occupation of that country, which came crashing down spectacularly during Biden's presidency's first year in office, August 2001. And now we face a situation where the United States, on top of those two relatively recent crises, after all, 2021 is not the distant past, is now facing this succession of major geopolitical crises. Okay, and the thing about when you think about these, where these crises are occurring, okay, they're occurring in Ukraine, which is in the western part of the Eurasian landmass. They're occurring in Gaza, which is the southeastern part of the Eurasian landmass, and we're facing an ongoing crisis in Taiwan, which is the eastern periphery of the Eurasian landmass. And that is geopolitically significant because for the past 500 years, ever since the continents of the world first came into steady contact, and then we thus have a world history and world empires, the epicenter of global power, where empires rise and fall, is on the Eurasian landmass. So it may seem far away from American voters, far from our immediate concern, but this is where world power is played out. It's on Eurasia. Eurasia constitutes roughly 70% of the world's population and productivity. And it has such a preponderant impact on human affairs that what happens in Eurasia ramifies across the globe.
I want to back up a little bit. That is, I can recall many of us thinking that the what happened with Vietnam, with the war on Southeast Asia, was a turning point in empire, that things percolated since then off of that U.S. defeat. Where do you fit in that, you know, that war and what came after?
Sure. If we stick with this idea that you, as you said in your introduction, okay, all empires from their beginning to end face crises. And then it's not the absence or presence of crises. They're a constant, right? The mere fact of imposing your hegemony over a foreign people or for an empire, a whole array of foreign peoples, means that there are going to be constant eruptions, all right, in this vast sprawling apparatus called empire. So in the early phases when empires are at their peak, they're strong, their resources are great, their military power is potent, they can manage these crises successfully. Now, they may be controversial, they may be bloody, they may be difficult. Their end, from an imperial perspective, may be unsatisfactory, but they're managed. But then as the empire begins to wane, the crises accumulate, the toll gets ever higher, and the sum becomes nothing less than the disintegration of an empire. So, you asked about Vietnam. Well, let's go back. You know, back in the 1950s, when the U.S. empire was strong, the 1940s and 50s, we faced that succession of crises that I described earlier, you know, Italy, Greece, Italy, France, Berlin, Korea. And they were difficult, Korea, very difficult, but managed. Then, 20 years into the Cold War, U.S. global power beginning to ebb a bit from its peak right after World War II. The rest of the world is beginning to develop. The world economy is growing. No longer does the United States have, as we had at the end of World War II, about 50% of the world's productivity and the world's gross product. And so then what happened was the first major blow to U.S. global power was, of course, the abortive Bay of Pigs invasion by the CIA in Cuba, and then the Cuban Missile Crisis, okay? And then falling hard on that, on those two events, because Bay of Pigs was 1961, Cuban Missile Crisis is 62, and then the world powers realizing that the North Atlantic sort of shooting gallery is tinder dry for thermonuclear war, that we can't afford to have another Cuban Missile Crisis. It was too dangerous. They then shift to remoter terrain, more remote terrain, safer areas, and move from direct confrontation to to surrogate warfare, avoiding the possibility of an escalation into a thermonuclear apocalypse. And that was Vietnam. So, Bay of Pigs, 1961, Cuban Missile Crisis, 1962, start of Vietnam War, 1965. That proved to be, just like the Bay of Pigs invasion, another disaster for U.S. foreign policy, but nonetheless, the United States recovered. We went into détente with the Soviet Union, kind of, you know, trying to control the nuclear arms race. We shifted away from, you know, direct involvement like Vietnam to surrogate warfare, and we fought the last 15 years of the Cold War through covert operations in Angola, Central America and Afghanistan. Angola was a loss for the United States. Afghanistan was a loss for the Soviet Union. But basically what happened was the United States adapted, we recalibrated, and we came up with a strategy for the final phase of the Cold War that allowed us to outlast the Soviet Union and essentially win the Cold War. So, in effect, the Vietnam War was a great crisis. The aftermath was politically very divisive in the United States, economically very difficult. It created a power vacuum in Southeast Asia that the Russians quickly filled and all that. Okay, but nonetheless, it was managed. And what we're seeing now is, if you will, a very different phase in the history of the U.S. empire, where after two major reverses in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and Afghanistan just ended back in 2021, just a couple of years ago, we now have these three successive simultaneous crises at these key points ringing the Eurasian landmass in Ukraine, Gaza, and the Taiwan Straits.
You're listening to global historian Alfred McCoy from the University of Wisconsin-Madison History Department. We're talking about, well, global crises and the decline, question mark, of the U.S. empire. Al McCoy, you wrote that in both success and failure, crisis management usually entails a delicate balance between domestic politics and global geopolitics. You know, of course, there's the axiom of the Wisconsin School historians headed by William Apman Williams decades ago that argued that the country's foreign policy has always been driven by often contentious domestic concerns.
Sure.
You state that the country's current plight can be traced at least in part to a growing imbalance between a domestic politics that appears to be coming apart at the seams
in a series challenging global upheavals. Go into that some. Talk about that growing imbalance as you see it.
Sure. One of the things that happened during World War II, which is the immediate preceding period for the U.S. ascent to global power, was that a couple of things. First of all, a U.S. industry was transformed into a military-industrial complex, as President Eisenhower later called it. So we developed an enormous armaments industry and a capacity to build an army capable of exercising global power. Moreover, we produced a very talented generation of military leaders who, in the post-war world, provide us with really skilled leadership. And third, the mobilization of the nation for global war sent roughly 16 million Americans overseas to fight in battlegrounds that stretched really right around the world and immersed them all in the world beyond the borders of the United States. So with the capacity, the leadership, and a mass or popular base for a global presence, the United States had the apparatus for an empire, particularly as a democratic society. And right after World War II, there was a really militant form of Republican isolationism that had emerged under the leadership of Mr. Republican, Senator Robert Taft of Ohio. It was called Brickerism, and it was the immediate intellectual antecedent of Trump's America First policy. And it was the Republican Party's choice of Dwight Eisenhower as its presidential candidate and as president for two terms that really brought the Republican Party into this bipartisan consensus that committed the United States to the exercise of global power. And that bipartisan policy continued throughout the Cold War. But when the Cold War ended, right away with the Pat Buchanan campaign in the early 1990s for the Republican nomination, you saw this resurgence of this very deep America First isolationist strain. And Trump has captured this, and this is now becoming a dominant strain in the Republican Party. And it's this which has blocked the Congress from approving the $60 billion that President Biden has requested to continue the support for Ukraine. Now, from a geopolitical perspective, Biden's strategy is very skillful. He's used the Russian invasion of Ukraine to consolidate NATO to get a genuine commitment to NATO to rebuilding their armaments complex. They've also incorporated two very important nations in NATO geopolitically, Sweden and Finland. And Sweden, after the end of the Cold War, maintained its navy and its air force, but it actually basically abolished its army. You had a major state without a ground force. Well, they're now rebuilding its army, their army, in order to join NATO. All right, so Biden was very skillful in this regard. But because of this shift in the Republican Party, the end of the bipartisan foreign policy that really has started in December 7, 1941, at the start of World War II, continued through the whole Cold War, this has begun to break down. And if the United States doesn't continue to supply armaments to Ukraine, the Russian army will continue its merciless grind, disregarding casualties, massive bombardments, and its grind across eastern Ukraine. And if Putin scores a win, that will be a major geopolitical blow to the United States, to Europe, and will mark the ascent of a kind of revived Sino-Soviet bloc that we saw during the Cold War on the Eurasian landmass. And so it's really that breakdown in bipartisanship and the revival of Republican isolationism that is bedeviling Biden. And also it's not just an American concern. The Europeans are watching this, and they realize that Trump is not just an individual leader. Indeed, the Pure Charitable Trust did a survey, and they found that between I think it was March of 2022 and December 2023, the number of Republicans who were who were opposed to U.S. aid to Ukraine increased from 9% to 48%. In other words, half the Republicans don't support aid for Ukraine anymore. That's a major breach. Nothing like that in the Cold War. And so this is a fundamental change. And with the United States doesn't have bipartisan support for a basically an international or global foreign policy, then the U.S. is starting to retreat. And the Europeans, seeing this, following this, they realize that they're going to have to take charge of their own defense. That, you know, the NATO alliance, if it survives, might be surviving without the United States. And I think it's very likely that a Trump presidency might very well withdraw from NATO. It's a very real possibility. But even if it doesn't, the threat of that and the qualified U.S. commitment to NATO under Trump, we'll support you for this but not for that, breaking with NATO, insisting on initiating a re-elected President Trump, breaking with NATO, insisting on negotiations with Putin over Ukraine, would essentially be tantamount to surrender. That would be an enormous breach in the NATO alliance.
Al McCoy, you used the word diffident in regard to Biden's handling of the U.S. end, anyway, of the Ukraine crisis. How would you describe, is it diffident, a diffident policy in regard to Israel and Gaza?
Let's look at two photographs here, to get a kind of freeze frame assessment here. Okay, back in 2018, everybody who's paying attention to politics will recall President Trump's press conference in Helsinki, Finland, with Putin of Russia, in which Trump essentially abased himself, said that he believed Putin over his own intelligence community about Russian interference in the 2016 election. Essentially, this is right after the Russia had taken Crimea, didn't raise the ongoing Russian military operations in eastern Ukraine, the Donbass region, essentially signaled to Putin that as far as he was concerned, Putin could continue his aggression. Okay, it was an enormously embarrassing moment for U.S. foreign policy. It produced howls of outrage among the commentariat in the United States, particularly liberals. And now let's move forward to another meeting, October 18th of last year, when President Biden, right after the October 7th Hamas attacks on Israel, those brutal, appalling attacks. Okay, I mean, let's be clear about that. It's just what happened you just look at the photographs and it's enormously disturbing. Okay, so Biden, feeling those emotions of concern, having been a lifelong supporter of Israel, flew off to Tel Aviv and sat down with Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel and essentially abased himself before Netanyahu, just the way Trump had abased himself before Putin. In other words, accepted, just as Trump accepted Putin's construction of the world, Biden accepted Netanyahu's construction of the world, that the only thing that mattered was Hamas's barbarism and other things like, for example, the 1993 Oslo Accord, which is supposed to establish two states, a Palestine and an Israel, side by side, living in peace, that Netanyahu has spent the last 15 years subverting, didn't mention that, okay? Not at all, even though that's been U.S. bipartisan foreign policy for the past, since 1993, is supporting a two-state solution. He just, again, he gave Netanyahu a complete pass, and then, he compounded that by sending Israel massive number of bombs. I believe we air freighted in very quickly some 15,000 bombs, including the 2,000-pound bunker busters, which were then dropped on buildings in Gaza and produced a great deal of destruction. And then as the Palestinian casualties, approached 20,000, Biden became concerned. There was a backlash inside the Democratic Party and some critical constituencies, Arab Americans in Michigan, that protest vote during the recent primary, African Americans nationwide, and then, among young people, the younger part of the electorate across the country, who are and were very concerned about the Palestinian death toll, which is now up to well over 30,000, about 32,000 now, the spreading hunger, the famine, and the fact that most of the Palestinians killed are women and children. This is surprisingly, a disturbingly high number of children being killed. And this is, is disturbing a lot of people in the Democratic constituency. And so Biden is now being forced to recalibrate and shift, but a little late. And it could be something that might cost him, his election future.
You're listening to UW historian Alfred McCoy. We're talking about, the global situation at present, focused upon the state of the U.S. empire, decline, and crisis. If you want to join with this conversation with a comment, a question, an observation for Al McCoy today, give us a call at 608-256-2001.
Alan, we haven't swung all the way across to the less visible crisis in the Taiwan Straits. I wonder.
Please go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. So as I said earlier, the epicenter of world power is Eurasia, and if you look at the map, these crises are strategically placed right around the rim of Eurasia. Ukraine in the west, Gaza in the southwest, and then the Taiwan Straits in the east. And let's not forget that during the Cold War, the United States built rings of steel around Eurasia in order to contain the Sino-Soviet communist bloc behind the Iron Curtain, which stretched for 5,000 miles across the Eurasian landmass. And that included military alliances, starting with NATO in Europe, going to CENTO in the Middle East, CETO in Southeast Asia, ANZUS in Australia, and then a string of five bilateral mutual defense pacts stretching down the Pacific littoral from Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, the Philippines, and Australia. And then on top of that, we ringed the continent with about 800 military bases, many of them air bases, armadas of missiles and aircraft, in order to control, to dominate the Eurasian landmass. And so these conflicts erupting on Eurasia is indicating that beneath the visible surface of conflict, something fundamental is happening. The United States is losing control over Eurasia. The rise of China, the Belt and Road Initiative, China's $1.2 trillion, that's not billion, but trillion-dollar aid package, 10 times the size of the Marshall Plan that the United States used to reconstruct Europe after World War II, has given China influence that stretches right across the Eurasian landmass, right around the continent of Africa, and is building an internal infrastructure of pipelines, roads, and rails across Eurasia to knit those two continents, Europe and Asia, together. And China is benefiting geopolitically by this fundamental shift. And so it's not surprising that these eruptions are occurring all around that landmass. And ultimately, probably for the United States, the most dangerous is not Ukraine. That's a European problem, ultimately. Not Gaza. That's going to be a Middle Eastern problem, and Middle Eastern powers are aware of this. The real problem for the United States is along the Pacific littoral in the Taiwan Straits. This has long been, if you will, the linchpin of the fulcrum of U.S. global power. It's been the presence of the United States along the Pacific littoral since the end of World War II that allowed the United States to defend one continent, North America, and functionally dominate another, Eurasia. And China is building up a massive navy, a huge armada, the world's biggest armada of missiles, a very significant air force, 2,400 jet fighters. And China is building up a steady force of military power, sufficient so that they are going to be, I think, within the next 2-3 years, in a position where they could simply not start a war, simply ramp up their their pressure on Taiwan. And that pressure is constant. Something the United States did, by the way, back in the Cold War. We not only set up bases along the Pacific littoral, but we also set up something called an ADIZ, okay, an Air Defense Identification Zone. And during the Cold War, the United States unilaterally extended its sovereign airspace from the 3-mile limit, 250 miles out there. This doesn't exist in treaty or law. This is simply a unilateral U.S. action taken at the peak of global power. And we got our Pacific littoral allies to do the same. Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and the Philippines all set up these air defense identification zones. Well, in 2020, the People's Republic of China, mainland China, penetrated Taiwan's airspace 400 times. Last year, 2023, they penetrated Taiwan's airspace 1,700 times. And they penetrated so many times that Taiwan no longer scrambles fighters to meet the mainland fighters as they penetrate Taiwan airspace. They're also compromising freedom of navigation in the Taiwan Strait. And they're slowly ramping up this pressure. And if you want an example of how China does this, okay, back in 2014, they began dredging shoals and turning them into islands in the South China Sea. And they now have, you know, and they just went from dredging, there was no announcement, and then they put a few buildings up, and then they put a short runway up, and then they put some radar up, and then they put, you know, air defense radar and extended the runways long enough to handle military aircraft, and now they've got 6 military bases in the in the Spratly Islands and the Paracel Islands in the middle of the South China Sea, and, you know, there was no point at which there was anything could be done. Well, China's kind of, if you will, cobra-like, well, you know, kind of, it's snake-like squeeze play on Taiwan's sovereignty is proceeding the same way. And what would the United States do if Beijing announces that this is that Taiwan is part of China's customs zone, and they are imposing a customs embargo on Taiwan? All aircraft flying to Taiwan must fly to mainland China first. All ships going to Taiwan must call at Chinese ports first. And they simply encircle Taiwan with aircraft and ships. Is the United States going to send aircraft carriers to confront Chinese ships enforcing that blockade? Because if they do, China has hundreds of carrier killer missiles that will sink those aircraft. We might knock a few missiles out of the sky, but they have hundreds of them. They'll sink, you know, so how many aircraft carriers are we willing to sacrifice? The answer is probably none. So Taiwan's going to be lost. And what will happen is that chain of islands that has been the fulcrum of U.S. geopolitical power since the 1950s will be broken. And we'll have to retreat to what's called the second island chain, Guam, and that'll be the exercise of our power. We'll be pushed back into the Central Pacific. And we haven't been there since the 1930s.
Al McCoy, Jade, our producer, informs me that a listener by the name of Thomas called, not on the air with us, but Jade sent me a quote from Thomas. That is, the West is in chaos, and it's only going to get worse. He thinks This is because the West is trying to police the rest of the world. Global policemen, certainly it seems from a bygone era at this point.
So the question is the United States acting as a global policeman? During the Cold War, we did. We had such a preponderance of military force, such an overwhelming share of the world economy, that we could intervene unilaterally around the world. And it wasn't always successful. I mean, look at the Bay of Pigs. Look at Eisenhower's intervention in Lebanon in 1958. It wasn't a disaster, unlike Reagan's intervention in Lebanon, but it wasn't very productive. But nonetheless, we could intervene militarily, and more importantly, the threat, the possibility of U.S. intervention gave the United States enormous geopolitical and diplomatic leverage. So yeah, we were, on our side of the Iron Curtain, which was, two-thirds of the world, or thereabouts, we were the world's policemen. And we did intervene very frequently, covertly, through CIA covert operations that were usually, at least in the short term, successful. That era has passed. We're now in an era where U.S. has had steady economic growth. Our military, of course, has grown apace, but the world is more than caught up with us. All right, the world is no longer in ruins like it was back in 1945. Moreover, the global economy has expanded, so there are no longer just four major industrial centers in the world like there were back in 1945. Economic activity is now dispersed widely around the globe. So that means that basically we're now dealing in a much more multipolar world than we were at the start of U.S. hegemony, at the start of the U.S. great global empire. And Biden has been quite skillful in playing that. So all of our intervention around the world, the exercise of what remains, and quite a bit remains of U.S. global power and influence, has to be done multilaterally. And that's why, for that reason, that Trump's election will be a fundamental rupture. I mean, the man is, if nothing, he's a very proud American unilateralist. He not only wants to retreat into the United States, he wants to abandon multilateral alliances, he doesn't like trade pacts, he wants to exercise U.S. power unilaterally. Well, in a multipolar world, the unilateral exercise of U.S. global power will be a disaster, and it will precipitate very quickly a U.S. decline.
Jay tells me that we have a caller. Steve, hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, Al. Addressing Mr. Alfred McCoy, I would argue that the U.S. has never achieved a truly stable empire after World War II. Number one, the present Ukraine crisis is merely the latest iteration of the post-Yalta, post-Potsdam disputes with Russia over the fate of Eastern Europe. Number two, the current Taiwan Straits crisis dates to mainland China's never accepting the Formosa's independence after 1949. And number three, North Korea never accepted the permanent division of the peninsula after 1953, leading to serial and ongoing U.S. North Korean nuclear crises. Thank you.
Alan, should I respond?
Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
Yeah, I agree with the caller, and there are two things. First of all, in the article I said that in the evolution or the origin of each of these three crises in Ukraine, Gaza, and the Taiwan Straits, and is, as the caller indicated in his remarks, is the culmination of basically 30 years plus of misguided U.S. foreign policy. We dealt with situations in Ukraine, for example, right after the end of the Cold War. Ukraine became instantaneously the world's third largest nuclear power. The main U.S. objective in the immediate Cold War period in Ukraine was nuclear disarmament, transferring Ukraine's a vast arsenal of about 5,000 nuclear warheads to Russia, and denuclearizing. And in exchange for that, at the Budapest Agreement in the early 1990s, the U.S. gave Ukraine assurances of its security. In diplomatic parlance, an assurance is not a guarantee. It's kind of like writing a bad check on a bank account with no money in it. Okay, so the ongoing Russian pressure on Ukraine is very much a consequence of that post-Cold War decision. Same thing in Taiwan. Back in 1979, the United States did two things. One, we recognized the People's Republic of China as one China. Okay, there's only one China, not two Chinas. And at the same time, the U.S. Congress in 1979 passed the Taiwan Relations Act, which required us to support Taiwan's independence. So right from the beginning of our relations with the People's Republic as a recognized state, there was this embedded contradiction that we kind of patched together at the time to meet the historic relationship the United States had with Taiwan, the very strong domestic support for Taiwan in the Republican Party. And so we put together this jury-rigged, you know, one China, but we also recognize Taiwan, which is a complete contradiction. And it started coming undone a couple of years ago when President Xi Jinping announced at a meeting of the Chinese Communist Party that the reunification with Taiwan was something that would not be deferred, that was something that China was going to actively pursue. And Biden, of course, countered that, you know, we would defend Taiwan. He said that at least three times. And so we're now in this very difficult situation in Taiwan. So, indeed, all right, you know, as the caller said, you know, the problems we're facing now in Taiwan and elsewhere is very much a product of foreign policy compromises that we made in the past. But more broadly, look, no empire is free from crisis. All empires, you extend the rubric of your sovereignty beyond your own borders. You incorporate within your hegemony disparate peoples. And there, every empire's history is the history of this endless succession of crises. The art of empire is maintaining the aura of stability amidst incessant instability. All right, and it's only in retrospect when we look at the British Empire and we think, you know, that it was mighty and powerful and stable, sitting there literally like the Rock of Gibraltar, which is one of the few things that remains of the British Empire today. Yeah, thinking of is this, in retrospect, this artifact of stability. No, it was in constant flux. There were constant crises in the history of the British Empire, right? Again, as I said, empires, when they're young and strong, they manage the crises more or less effectively, at least from their perspective. But as they begin to grow weak, those crises begin to accumulate. They drain the support for the imperial project in the homeland. They strain the fiscal and military resources of the imperial power. And eventually, the imperial power, you know, comes to an end, as the British did at Suez in 1956 and the Russians did in Afghanistan in the 1980s.
Al McCoy, in the closing section, I have a reverb. In the closing section of your essay, you talk about the sum of three crises. That is, that whether it be Taiwan or Gaza or Ukraine, each one of them should but can't demand full attention because of what else is going on. Talk about that. The dilemma now in the sum of three crises that are going on simultaneously.
Right. Well, at a very, you know, simple level, Ukraine, because of the nature of this kind of trench warfare that's being waged in eastern Ukraine, is a voracious consumer of both missiles, artillery shells, and armored equipment. And so we're trying to do two things simultaneously. Well, actually, three things. We're trying to maintain our own defense establishment, our own defense capacity. We're trying to provide Taiwan with weapons that will allow them to at least maintain the aura of a capacity to make the cost of a mainland Chinese invasion prohibitively high. And we're trying to give Ukraine, hundreds of thousands of NATO-caliber artillery shells in order to continue this brutal trench warfare. At the same time, we're trying to balance our defense budget. And the three priorities are coming undone in Congress, where the Republican majority is increasingly unwilling to float deficits to do this. We have two crises, that neither one of which we're handling very well. Moreover, the Gaza crisis is although it's not materially significant, it's morally quite significant. And what it is doing at the same time is internationally and domestically, it's eroding, if you will, U.S. moral authority, the legitimacy of U.S. global power. And so the combination of the material strains from Taiwan and Ukraine, combined with the ongoing moral blows as the world watches in increasing horror at the starvation and the civilian casualties among Palestinians, and blames the United, whether correctly or not, the United States for a great deal of responsibility for this. It's the combination of the material and the moral, all of which is occurring around the rim of the Eurasian landmass, the epicenter of global power, could potentially be a combination that, in retrospect, historians will look back and say, yes, this was America's Suez Canal crisis. This was America's Afghan crisis.
We have but a few minutes left in the hour. If there's any of you out there that want to get in with a final question, a comment, 608-256-2001. And in the wings waits Donald Trump. You wrote that Donald Trump waiting in the wings may try to escape such foreign entanglements and their political costs by reverting to the Republican Party's historic isolationism, which we touched on, even as he ensures that the former lone superpower of planet Earth could come apart at the seams in the wake of his election 2024. If so, such a distinctly quagmire world in such a distinctly quagmire world, American global hegemony would fade with surprising speed, soon becoming little more than a distant memory. A kind of quite the scenario you laid out there, Alfred McCoy.
Yeah, the Trump presidency is becoming, with each passing day, a greater reality. And even if he doesn't win, it still is behooves us to consider what might happen if he does, okay? So let's think about this. First of all, Trump is, as an American first, is not going to manage U.S. multilateral alliances effectively. He's very hostile to NATO. He's hostile to the bilateral defense pacts we have along the Pacific littoral. And so he's likely to diminish the quality of those alliances. In an era when, you know, we're now in a multipolar world, or at least emerging or heading in that direction, so Trump's attempt to exercise U.S. power unilaterally in a multipolar world is going to produce complications and contradictions. Second matter is that this multilateral management that the U.S. engages in, which Biden is actually pretty good at, and, you know, his foreign policy team is not brilliant, but they're competent. And they've proven reasonably skilled, particularly in the Ukraine crisis, in dealing with Europe, in marshaling Europe to back Ukraine, okay, and to expand and strengthen NATO. Well, if you look at the kind of Trump team that's going to come on board, these are going to be loyalists. These are not going to be people like General McMaster who was his national security advisor for a while. It's not going to be the competent professionals. Trump is determined to have sycophants, and second tier or third team, the C team in foreign policy is simply not going to cut it in a multilateral world. There will be a succession of just straight out diplomatic bungles, because people that are trying to exercise what remains of U.S. global power will be doing it incompetently, and that will compound the structural decline of the United States. So I'm willing to state that by the end of a second Trump term, we will no longer be speaking of the United States as, to what former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright called the indispensable power, the preeminent power, even a superpower. It'll be over. That's my feeling. I could be wrong, but that's my feeling.
You know, if we hurry, we can squeeze in one late caller here. Roger, if you can make it quick, we'll get you going. Roger, you're on the air.
Yeah. So speaking as a liberal, tell me why isolationism isn't better for avoiding nuclear catastrophe and constant warfare. Maybe we're better off with an isolationist. I'd like to hear the arguments against isolationism, please.
Right now, historically, the America First movement of the late 1930s was succeeded by Hitler's invasion of Poland and the start of World War II. Isolationism, arguably, during the 1920s and 30s, in an era of the rise of authoritarianism, probably wasn't a good idea. In our own era, we're looking at the rise of authoritarians, of Xi Jinping in China, who wants to incorporate Taiwan forcibly and expand Chinese power to adjacent areas of Asia unilaterally and forcefully. Putin regards the collapse of the Soviet Empire as the greatest tragedy of the 20th century. He's doing his best to rebuild the Soviet Empire. So, the U.S. is, one of at least four major blocks of power on the globe. If we retreat, that is going to destabilize the international situation and have consequences and ramifications that ultimately reach back home.
We're pretty much going to have to leave it there, Al McCoy. I want to thank you ever so much once again for doing what you do and for being our guest on WORT. I want to thank...
Alan, could I slip in one thing? Hi.
Please.
Yeah. Next Tuesday at 5 o'clock in the State Historical Society, I'm going to be moderating a panel with John Nichols of the Cap Times on waging peace in Vietnam. And I'll be on a panel with Ron Haberle. You may remember that name. Mm-hmm. He was the man who took the My Lai massacre photographs, which were the searing images of that massacre. And I think it's a panel that people would appreciate hearing, particularly the WRT audience.
I have the flyer on my refrigerator. Thanks for reminding me, Al McCoy. Again, I want to thank Jade. I want to thank Jack for engineering. I want to thank you, our listeners and callers. I've been your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff, and I'll be speaking with you next week. Recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Ha ha. Don't take no prisoners if you can't afford to feed none. Don't start no fights if you cannot predict the outcome. Don't make donations where you cannot get your dough back.
You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. It's the same recorded message you've been saying all along. Keep handing us the Bible while you're walking off with all the gold. The bureaucratic office sends you merry-go-rounding, while the KKK police the streets by bloodhounding. Interest on the credit card just keeps on compounding, but the FCC can never shut this pirate sound down. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded with information.
information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that will never be reported.
Peace. Hello, this is Julie Candler with the BBC News. The founder of the cryptocurrency exchange FTX, Sam Bankman-Fried, has been sentenced to 25 years in jail in the United States for fraud and money laundering. He had earlier been found guilty of stealing billions of dollars from his customers in one of the biggest financial frauds in US history. Michelle Fleury reports.
A US judge has sentenced Sam Bankman-Fried to 25 years in prison for orchestrating what prosecutors have called one of the biggest financial frauds in American history. He has also been ordered to forfeit $11 billion, which will go towards compensating victims. Judge Lewis Kaplan said this was a very serious crime. It caps a meteoric rise and fall for crypto's former golden boy. After creating FTX, one of the world's biggest crypto trading platforms, he was convicted last November of 7 counts, including fraud and conspiracy. Mr. Bankman-Fried is expected to appeal his conviction.
Judges at the World Court have unanimously ordered Israel to take all necessary action to ensure basic food supplies reach the Palestinian population in Gaza. They said famine was taking hold in Gaza. Israel has denied that its military campaign aimed at Hamas is illegal. James Elder from the UN children's charity UNICEF said people in Gaza were living in fear for their lives.
They are so exhausted by this nightmare that they have said that they want it to be over and they want to be hit by a bomb. And the horrendous reality is that you hear things here all the time that you shouldn't normally hear.